I'm sure that everybody believes what you have just sang so enthusiastically, that one day he's coming, and that's going to be a great day. Reviewing again kind of our key verse, 1 Corinthians 10:32, in which the command is given to give none offense, neither to the Jews, nor the Gentiles, nor to the church of God. So in these four mornings, we've endeavored to make comments on quite a large span, from eternity past into eternity future, and then a period we believe that brings about the end of time. And then we went back here to the time of Christ, filled in a little bit here of the period from creation to the flood, or at least the restoration of the flood, and then the 1400 year history of the Jews up until the captivity. And then we've talked about the Gentiles in this period, and then on down to the conclusion. And so this morning we'll be filling in this period here, which deals primarily with the church. Yesterday we set a period in here which we believe is the 70th week of Daniel, which did not run consecutively with the other weeks that are talked about. Various names are given to this seven-year period. Some call it the time of Jacob's trouble, but probably the most descriptive name is the Great Tribulation. So you see, all three of these streams of truth lead up to this point, which we believe is the point at which Christ will come and set up his kingdom. So we're working in here the matter this morning of the church. Now, as we use this term, I think that there are probably as many ideas about what it means as there are people in the room. And so, when we talk about the church, we need to have definitions to start with. So, I'm going to try to stick with just two concepts this morning. One of them is very technical. Technically speaking, the church, I believe, is the ecclesia, the called out. Over in Revelation 13:8, we read the other day that the only people who would not worship this world ruler were those whose names were written in the Lamb's Book of Life. So in the strictest sense and narrowest sense, when we use the word church this morning, we're speaking of the called out, those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Then we're going to talk about something else, and I'm afraid that just from force of habit, I will probably lapse over and use the word church. But this is not my intention. We want to refer to something else as the ecclesiastical institution. This is a religious organization, institution. Now, there may be in the framework of this institution those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. But you fall in the distinction that I'm trying to make. So first of all, we're going to take up God's plan for the called out, those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life as distinguished from the visible ecclesiastical institution with its man-worshipping religion. Although, as I say, there may be and probably are members whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life within the institution. So to deal with the called out, 1 Thessalonians 4, 14 through 17 is our first passage and a very well known passage. We remember that in the days of Paul there was great enthusiasm concerning the expectancy of the soon return of Christ. And as the believers were waiting for his return, some of their number died. And so they felt, or they wondered, are those of our number who have died going to miss out on the great blessing that's going to accompany Christ's return? So Paul clarified this in 1 Thessalonians 4, 14 through 17. So reading in verse 14, for if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so them also which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him. Now you're concerned about these of our number that have died. When Christ returns, he's going to bring them with him. So don't get too exercised about this. Then he elaborates, verse 15, for this we say unto you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not precede them which are asleep. Those whose bodies are asleep in the grave, while you're worrying about whether they're going to get in on this great experience or not, the fact of the matter is that we're in second place and they're in first. He's going to bring them with him that have already died. Then he says, verse 16, for the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. So this clarified the anxiety they had, didn't it? What's going to happen to people that have died when Christ comes? Well, he's going to bring them with him. They will actually be raised up first. Then we which are alive and remain will all join together to be with the Lord. 1 Corinthians 15, 51 through and 52 give us further information on this subject. I'm sure these are very familiar passages to many of you. Verse 51, he says, behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep. Now, incidentally, as I understand it, there is no justification in Scripture for the so-called doctrine of soul sleep. Every time the word is used, sleep, in connection with humans, it refers to their bodies, not their souls. So he says, I show you a mystery. All of us, Christians, are not going to experience death. Our bodies are not all going to go in the grave. I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. Now, we were making a distinction a moment ago between those who had already died and those who are alive, but the time element is really very slight because he says in verse 52, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Doesn't take very long to blink your eye, does it? Well, that's the only time lapse that will be there. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. So, there are those who will be living at the time of Christ that will never experience death, but will go into their glorified body that we talked just briefly about the other day instantaneously. Now, those who carry on further in these verses imagine that there are going to be two great songs, that is, lines of songs sung. And so those that are alive are going to look down as they're going to join the Lord and say, O death, where is thy sting? Never touched us. And then those that have experienced death, they're being resurrected, are going to add another line to the song. And they will sing, as we have it here in verse 54. That's verse 55. And they're going to say, O grave, where is thy victory? You folks that never died, you've got something to brag about, be thankful about. You say, O death, where is thy sting? But we're going to say, O grave, where is thy victory? We are out of it. Luke 17:26-36 appears to bear on this subject further. Christ was being pressed to give an answer for more details concerning his return. And in verse 26 of Luke 17, he said, As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it also be in the days of the Son of Man. Verse 28, Likewise also it was in the days of Lot. They did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, and so forth. Verse 29, The same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Now we're going to put these together in a little bit. But the night before, he says, verse 34, I tell you, in that night there shall be two men in one bed. The one shall be taken, and the other shall be left. On one third of the earth, it is night when this event occurs, and two men are in a bed. And when Christ raptures the believers out of the earth, the believer's taken, and the man in the same bed with him that was a non-believer is left. An early morning task of women in many parts of the world is to get up and to beat the corn or the wheat or whatever they have into flour so they can fix breakfast. So he says, early in the morning, two women shall be grinding together, carrying on a conversation, and all of a sudden, one will disappear, and the other will be left. Two men shall be in the field. On the rest of the earth, it's daytime. Some parts of the earth morning, some afternoon, men working in the field. The one shall be taken, and the other left. I believe there's an Old Testament reference, Isaiah 26, verses 20 and 21, which are dealing with this event, which we refer to as the rapture of the church, although this word does not appear in Scripture. But in this particular passage in Isaiah 26, verses 20 and 21, there is a call, Come, my people. Enter thou into thy chambers, and shut thy doors about thee. Hide thyself, as it were, for a little moment, until the indignation be overpast. Just as though he is saying now, Come out of the earth, I want to hide you away, until the indignation is overpast. Verse 21, For behold, the Lord cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. Now, this sounds so fantastic and abnormal that it's very hard for us to believe that it could happen. Is it not? That one day, Christ is just going to remove all the Christians in the twinkling of an eye out of the earth. Well, the more you study about this, the more interesting it gets. We were studying about this back when I used to be aboard ship many years ago. As a part of what went on there, we used to meet about 15 minutes before breakfast and 15 minutes before we went to work at 1 o'clock. And in the evening, right after dinner, five or six of us for, well, really more than that, for just a little time of fellowship and prayer. One day I was busy and couldn't make the meeting. Pretty soon there was a pounding on the door of the office. I was in an office, didn't have any windows in it, behind a tin door. And I thought the fellow on the outside was going to tear the door down. So I let him in, one of my Christian buddies. And he was pale and shaking and trembling, and he got hold of me, and he said, "Boy, am I glad to see you." Well, I didn't know anything unusual that had happened, so he told me the story. He said, "I went down to the prayer meeting, and he said there wasn't anybody showed up. So I started in the first division, went looking for so-and-so, and he wasn't there. I went looking for so-and-so, and I couldn't find him. I looked for so-and-so." Well, you've already anticipated what happened. I know around the office occasionally we make the remark, we go out and won't see anybody around, and we'll say, "Well, maybe the rapture's taking place. Can't find anybody." A few years ago, up in one of the New England states, a probate judge had a problem on his hands because the will he was probating specified that at the time of his death, if the rapture had occurred, his money was to be used to produce a certain type of literature telling people that were here after the rapture how to be saved. And if the rapture hadn't occurred, his money was to be spent for something else. So a probate judge had to make a decision as to whether or not this event had occurred. And he made the decision that it had not occurred. I understand that there are a number of newspapers. You know, they, after some big event happens, they like to get an extra out on the street. That the research has been done, the copy's been written, and the type has been set. So there are a few newspapers that can get out an extra within the hour after this event happens. I don't know who's going to do the printing and the distribution, but they're planning on it. One of the large insurance firms in the world has waived a general requirement, which is if when somebody disappears, in order for the beneficiary to collect, why they like to have the body, you know, to prove the person's dead. They didn't want him to show up 2 or 3 years later when they thought he was dead. So insurance companies are pretty definite in demanding proof that the person on whose life they're paying off has actually died. And, of course, the best thing is a death certificate, which has the thumbprint taken by a doctor of the person who's died. But this particular insurance company, several years ago, as a sales promotion device, wrote into insurance they were selling that if there is sufficient evidence that this event has occurred, that the beneficiary will not have to wait the customary 7 years to collect their insurance. So, although this is a truth that is familiar only to a few Bible students of a particular bent, there are those in the world that have taken notice of it. I knew of a fellow once that I'm not sure I would agree with his methods in witnessing, but he had some success. But he used to pick up hitchhikers. And as soon as he had gotten them going down the road, he would say, "Is your life insurance paid up?" He says, "Because the reason I'm saying this, before we get to our destination, if the rapture occurs, I'm going to disappear. And if you don't grab this wheel in a hurry, well, you may not survive." Well, it would seem that such an event is in God's plan for those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And the question that comes to us next then is, when is this going to occur? And I expect that we are pretty widely representative of a number of views here in this room today. The three views held on this, one view is that this event will occur as the initial event of the seven-year period, the tribulation. Others believe it will occur at midpoint in the tribulation. And others believe it will occur at the end of the tribulation period. Those who believe that it will occur at the beginning or at the midpoint then anticipate two visits of Christ to the earth and describe these as being the first time Christ comes with the church, or rather for the church, and the second time he comes with the church. And there is scriptural background for believing this. In Revelation 1:7, I believe it is, it makes it very clear that when he comes, every eye shall see. And Christ repeatedly warned, in the latter days, when you hear rumors that Christ is here or he's there, he says, don't believe him. In fact, this seemed to be the main motivation of his teaching on his return, is there would be so many people rise up, false Christs in the last days, saying, I am Christ. He says, just like if you're facing east and it lightnings in the west, the reflection will go all the way around the horizon. No matter where you are in the world, he said, when I return, every eye shall see. So if anybody says Christ is over there in North Africa or he's in this part of the country, don't believe it. That's not Christ. When he comes, every eye shall see. But over in 2 Peter, he says, you know perfectly well that the Lord cometh as a thief in the night. Now, what kind of a thief is it that announces his coming so everybody can see when he comes? To be successful, a thief in the night comes undetected. That's 2 Peter 3:10. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. So you see, those who hold this view believe that Christ will come first as a thief in the night and take his own out of the world, where they will be kept during the great tribulation period. Then at the close, he will return with them. So we just wanted to point out that this view anticipates two visits. Those who hold this view have another theory. I'm going to call it a theory here. I want to call all these theories because I don't know when he's going to come. You remember yesterday we read in Romans 11:25 from the Phillips translation. I'll read that verse again. This partial insensibility which has come to Israel is only to last until the full number of the Gentiles has been called in. Some believe that there is a secret number which Christ wants to add to make up his body. And the minute that the last number, the last person to make up that number, has his name written in the Lamb's Book of Life, that Christ is going to call this group out. A very famous Bible teacher that believes this has used John 21:11 as an illustration. You remember this is when Christ miraculously helped them catch some fish. And verse 11 of John 21 says, Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of great fishes, and 153. And he was intrigued by this. Why would the Bible specify that there were 153 fish in that net. So he did some extensive research, or at least he thinks that he did and says that he did. And the results he reported from his research was that in that part of the sea, there are schools of a certain type fish that 153 makes up the school. And you never find more or less than that number. They keep it constant. So he saw that in the picture of Christ. As soon as the number is complete, he's going to lift them all out bodily to signify the next event in his timetable. So, when is this going to happen? Many people believe it will be the event which triggers the events of the seven-year period. Now, there are other people who hold to the mid-tribulation rapture idea. And they base this on the fact that I believe there are 11 references in Scripture to 3.5 years, 42 months, 1180 days, and so forth, which indicates that one half of this seven-year period is very much different from the other half. Some believe that the first half of this period is what they call a false millennium, because this world ruler will so be in control that the earth will really be a good place to live in, and there will be little, if any, diverse activity. It's at the midpoint that things break loose. This is the purpose of God rapturing the church out of the world, as we read in Isaiah 26. Come, my people, enter into my chambers until the indignation is overpast. Or, we read in Luke 17, the flood did not hit in judgment until Noah was taken out. And the fire and brimstone did not fall on Sodom and Gomorrah until Lot was taken out. So they see that this event will recur at the mid-period, just before the great indignation that seems to fall at the mid-period breaks out. But there are problems with both these views, because over in Revelation 13:8, we read this in a previous session, that everybody on earth would worship this great world ruler except those whose names were written in the Lamb's Book of Life. So during the period that he is having this great, I don't know what you'd call it, movement to get people to worship him, here are the believers right there. And those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life, they won't do it. So, they're not up in heaven. They're right down there when this happens. And in Revelation verse 7, John is telling about something that he saw. Verse 9 he says, and this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and peoples and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hand, and cried with a loud voice, salvation to our God, which sitteth upon the throne and unto the Lamb. So here's this great multitude in white robes out of every nation, kindred on the earth. And so, verse 13, one of the elders said, do you know who these are? Asked John if he knew who they were. Verse 14, he says, you know, I don't know. And he says, these are they which came out of the great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Now, I know that every person is able to reinforce his own view. So, many people say, well, these are not Christians. These are Jews. This isn't the church. And there are those who hold what is known as the partial rapture theory. And that is that those who have believed on Christ before the rapture, before the coming of Christ, will be taken out, but those who are saved after will remain behind. So as to when this event is going to occur and all the details of it, you've probably made up your own mind. And so I'm not going to try to give any one view or to try to persuade you. But in God's plan, the church, and I'm using it in its technical sense, those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life are going to be called out of this earth to be with Him. I heard a few years ago, as I was studying into this subject, of a commission within a religious body that has a press release prepared saying, yes, it's true that God took His people out. And the ones He took out were those narrow-minded people who said the only way you could be a Christian was to believe in Christ. And they believed all these funny doctrines. They got so obnoxious on earth that God took them out so the rest of us wouldn't be bothered with them. So that's the kind of a press coverage this event may get. There's got to be some explanation when it happens, and that is one explanation that's forthcoming. Well, so much for the first group we're talking about. Well, I should mention one other thing here. I think that Kenneth Wiest is a great Greek scholar. I believe he's highly respected. And if we can accept his rendering of the original language, it'll save us a lot of problem in this matter as to when this event will occur, because he translates 2 Thessalonians 1:3. Do not begin to allow anyone to lead you astray in any way, because that day shall not come except the aforementioned departure of the church to heaven comes first, and the man of lawlessness is disclosed. So he says it's very clear that the events of a 7-year period are triggered after the church is taken out. However, the word that he talks about there being taken out, I understand in the original language, is the word apostasy. Now we're shifting gears over to the plan and history of the ecclesiastical institution, that religious body. And I want to be very careful in my choice of words here. But I think I'll just refer to it as the ecclesiastical institution. The characteristic as given in 1 Thessalonians 2:3 is that it is apostate, a rebellion against God. Now, in order to fit this in with what we believe the Bible teaches, we need to identify three persons that we're going to talk about just briefly. In Revelation 16 and verse 13, there are the mention of these three personages. He says that I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. The three personages there, then, are the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. In Revelation 19:20, it speaks again of the beast and the false prophet. In Revelation 20 and verse 10, do I have the right verse here? I guess I don't, but it's right in that vicinity of some place that he speaks of that dragon, Satan. I've missed the reference on it. But of the three personages, the dragon is mentioned as Satan. And this leaves two more, the beast and the false prophet. Now will you turn to Revelation 13 again. The other day, we read the opening verses of Revelation 13, 1 through 10, which described the great political ruler. Now we come to verse 11. I beheld another beast coming out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. Now let's see what he does. Verse 13. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of man. If you heard there was going to be an exhibition up in Denver this afternoon of a man that was going to call fire down from heaven, would you go see it? And if somebody said, why, this is just Christ repeating what he did in his days on earth, this man is going to do it. Verse 14, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. Now he's talking about the political ruler. He tells the people on earth, make an image. And the next verse said that he had power to give life to the image. And any that wouldn't worship the image would be killed. Verse 16, and he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. And no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So it looks like we've got kind of a world religion. And anybody who will not worship the animated image of the political ruler cannot get a ration card. He cannot buy or sell his money. It's no good. And he can't trade with anybody. And so, economically, I don't know what happens. I guess they'll starve to death if they won't worship this image. Who is it that's doing this? This is the second beast, and I think we can properly identify him as the false prophet. You have probably noticed in these studies we've been doing that I have not used the word Antichrist. This word does not appear in the book of Daniel or in the book of Revelation. But it does appear in John's epistles, and he speaks of the time that Antichrist will come. Down through the years, there's been such a closeness in the work of the political ruler and the ecclesiastical ruler that scholars have differed as to which is which. Which is the Antichrist? Are there two people? Or is there just one? So I think it's confusing to bring that in. So we're thinking about these two people then working together. One is the political head of the world empire, and the other is the ecclesiastical head. Now it seems that the political head, and this is speculation on our parts, the political head is dependent upon the sponsorship of the ecclesiastical head to be installed and maintained in power. This is the reason down through the years, some of the scholars have wondered if there were two persons, because here is the ecclesiastical head that's exercising all the power of the political head. And as I mentioned, it seems that the political head is somewhat dependent upon him. Now, why are we interested in this? The reason I'm interested in it and believe it, I believe that we're going to see before long the ecclesiastical institution as the most powerful voice on earth. Now, you know what would happen even in America if everybody synchronized their political belief with their religious belief. If all the religions unite into one party, they can put anybody in office that they want to. But this is just not the United States. This is worldwide. The next great powerful voice we see on earth is that of an ecclesiastical institution. Now you see, I've come up with a theory, and now I'm going to substantiate it. So you just turn it around and say, well, if you hadn't come up with a theory, why, you couldn't substantiate it. But I'm fascinated as I read the news from day to day. In the three areas of prophetic truth, we mentioned that there isn't a great deal of activity concerning the Gentile last empire, although we mentioned there's some things that might head up to it. The Jews seem to be a little active. But in this third realm, I think there's just one expression that explains it to me, and that is red hot. This is where the activity is taking place today. The week before the events of the Middle East, Time magazine in the religious section carried an article about a new organization, and they call themselves the Fraternity of Abraham. This is an organization of Catholics, Muslims, and Jews. And they meet regularly in Paris every 3 weeks. The association meets once every 3 weeks, and while carefully skirting political issues, freely exchanges theological views. Last week, members of the executive board agreed to set aside a 5-minute period in mid-June on their faith's respective Sabbaths, during which rabbis, priests, and ministers throughout France would preach understanding among the three great monotheistic religions. And you know the Vatican has a secretariat of their council that's working on what they call the Council of Non-Christian Religions. There is a great movement today to unite all religions. Out in California a few weeks ago, the successors to Bishop Pike said, why are we delaying? Why don't all we Protestants just go ahead and recognize the Pope as the head of Christianity? And some major denominational leaders said this is a good idea. Why don't we go ahead and do it? An event back in Kansas City a few months ago received nationwide publicity as the Catholics and the Protestants united to build St. Mark's Chapel, which they are using jointly in their work in Kansas City, Missouri. And it made the headlines of most religious magazines when the Catholics adopted the Bible, the Revised Standard Version translated by Protestant scholars. So the headlines came out and says, for the first time in history, one Bible, Catholics and Protestants. Now the Catholics, as you know, did make certain specifications, and the Protestants had to do two or three things to please them, but for all practical purposes, one Bible. During the famine in India recently, the Council on Relief of the World Council of Churches and the Catholic World Relief Organization united in their fundraising efforts and raised money and sent food to India as a united body. In another country I visited recently, I don't remember which one it was, I mentioned this and they said that's happening right here too. No more, two separate relief organizations, one. You are aware that last year the Committee on Church Union met down in Houston. They have another meeting early next year, which is a movement to unite 7 of the major Protestant denominations in America into one church. Also in 1968 in Uppsala, Sweden, where we have a couple working over there, our representative pointed out to me the building where the World Council meets next year in their next meeting on the merger of all the churches worldwide. And we know how the Vatican is working on this. Now, whether these two things match together or not, I'm not real sure. But I think it's very interesting to see the uniting of a great ecclesiastical institution into one group, which will end up eventually with one head. And I think we've read about it. here in Revelation. The man who is the ecclesiastical counterpart to the political ruler we have already talked about. I heard Dr. Charles Feinberg speak on this subject a while back, and he told a story about a policeman. That is, he was a candidate for policeman on the New York Police Force, and one of the questions he had to answer was, what are rabies, and what are you supposed to do about them? He said he had been asked the question, that's the reason he gave the answer, what are we supposed to do about this merger of these religious bodies? So the candidate for the police force misread this word rabies for rabbis. And he answered his question accordingly. And his answer was, rabies are Jewish ministers, and you're not supposed to do anything about them. So that was his advice. You see it happening? What are you supposed to do about it? Well, I'd like to add a word. And oh, we may have an opportunity to demonstrate discipleship, which this conference is all about, in a way which Christians have not had for many, many years. I have tried to verify this. I'm sorry that I didn't write it down when I heard it and trace it to its source. But I have heard that at least somebody is discussing, whether he's really introduced it or not, some congressman or senator, a resolution which would cause the Federal Communications Commission to deny the use of radio and TV or the airwaves for any religion which did not belong to the nationally recognized body. And furthermore, that someone suggested as a follow-up that for the purpose of contributions on your income tax, religious contributions would only be allowed to the nationally recognized religious body. My friend Dan Pyatt moves in circles, which has information on these things, and he and I were having dinner over in Tokyo a few months ago where he's setting up the crusade, and I said, Dan, what do you know about this? What do you believe? He said, well, this is new to me. But he said, as a result of the Billy Graham Pavilion in New York, I know this, that the only way that you can petition the government of New York is through the Catholic, Protestant, or Jewish organization. If you want to speak to the government, you have to go through one of those three avenues. So he said, I can see how it could happen, that the government would only respond to communication that comes through the body, the ecclesiastical body it recognizes. Well, it seems that there's a close relationship between the political and the ecclesiastical in the last days leading up to the coming of Christ. Well, I would like to bring this study to a great climax, but I just don't know how to do it. And as I thought about this, that we're talking about here this morning, the opportunity to demonstrate discipleship, back to Luke 21 again, when these things begin to happen, the response to the greater part of the world, verse 26 of Luke 21, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things that are coming on the earth. Even though there's a great deal of complacency and self-centeredness, the people who are not Christian are going to be shook up by these events. And the advice Christ gave to the Christians was, verse 28, and when you see these things begin to come up, begin to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. So be quite a contrast. The Christians are going to rejoice. Lift up your heads. Your redemption is near. And I think it'd be perfectly in order for us to talk to these other people that are so disturbed about why we are not disturbed and what is coming so shortly. In Ephesians 1, in the Phillips translation, I think we read this in the beginning. I want to read this in conclusion. For God has allowed us to know the secret of His plan. And it is this. He purposes in His sovereign will that all human history shall be consummated in Christ. That everything that exists in heaven or earth shall find its fulfillment in Him. And then 1 Corinthians 15, 24. Then, I better read back a little further. Then, and not until then, comes the end, when Christ, having abolished all other rule, authority, and power, hands over the kingdom to God the Father, Christ's reign will and must continue until every enemy has been conquered. And then he says, in the end, thus in the end shall God be holy and absolutely God, without a rebellious or disobedient element in the universe. That's where we're headed, where everything is subject to Christ. So if there's an application to these studies on God's plan of the ages, I think it is this. Why don't we enter into this right now so that there is no disobedient or rebellious element in us, but now, as it's going to be in the final climax, God is absolutely all. He is absolutely God. And we are absolutely obedient. Let's conclude with a word of prayer.